My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. And I am a member of the Miami Men's Group. About 100 irresponsible, uncurable males that meet twice a week. Last Thursday at the meeting of the Miami Men's Group, at a special meeting of the steering committee, I was given the authorization to wish you a happy and successful dinner. The vote of our committee was 11-7. I was invited up here because I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. And you can tell by looking at me, I've been someplace for a long time. So let me tell you about it. Don't miss any of this. Sit down, lady. I'm trying to talk. This is not an easy thing to do here. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City. And my neighborhood... Give me a little break here. Go play with yourself somewhere, will you? My neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you may not understand it here in the Palm Beaches, but they actually drank in that neighborhood. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You would see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Oh, yes. Hard to believe, but true. If you look at where I live, my mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits. And something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker. And in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out. So, when I showed up at the local joint and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another one coming through, another O'Keefe into the system. I'm not sure what they gave me that day, but I knew I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it smelled. I like the way it tastes. I like what it did for my head. I like the noise and the smoke and the confusion. And I like the fist fights and the Irish music. I like the bullshit. That's what I really like. Love the bullshit. And I went after it for the next 20 years. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking. And I got into all of the difficulties that you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly, when they were finished with me, I think someone made a mistake somewhere because I ended up going to college. Not only did I go to college, I went to college far away in a state that had no bars, only had restaurants. A state surely not intended to be part of this union. And these people sat around at tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang these dopey college songs, and they wore white shoes in the winter time. And because I had no moral fiber, I bought a pair of those shoes. I learned the words to some of those dopey songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was ending. Seemed like a safe bet. So one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco Harbor. I hate to be indelicate in front of such nice people. But I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier. You going to give me a break or what here? You got to get ahead of me? Nothing but trouble over here all night long. Stop that. So I went off on my first liberty in the great city of San Francisco, bought all the beer I could buy, drank all the beer I bought, returned to the ship, went to sleep, and then it happened. And I met one of my shipmates who slept below me. And I suppose, one can only suppose, that he knew he would be wet sometime in his naval career. And it just hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was just as distinguished. So I came back to the neighborhood some years later, older but no wiser, undecorated, unhonored, unloved. Everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was absent without permission from the New York City Police Department. Billy had a misunderstanding with a citizen, and the citizen alleged that he was thrown off a five-story roof. And the son of a bitch lived. To identify the cop who happened to be Billy. And so Billy went west. He went into a different line of work. He went in for the peace and quiet. He went back in the United States Marine Corps. And the government was giving veterans $20 a week for 52 weeks. That was known as the 5220 Club. I became a member of that right away, signed up for my checks, and gravitated back to the drinking place in the bar, and took up with some of my high school companions. I was planning a life of petty crime. And I remembered, you know those clear thoughts that come every once in a while? I remembered I'd been to college. So I said, let me go back there. So I did. I got on a bus and I went back up there, and I arrived in the middle of this blizzard and walked into this place, and there they were, sitting around the table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I signed up for another pair of shoes. And now a grateful government was sending me a check every month, so I was moderately solvent and therefore drunk. And one day I was staggering around the campus in my usual condition, and I noticed the list of graduates on the bulletin board, and my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. How quick the time passes. So I called the widow and told her of this great event. And she came north, and that was a very, very tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. Some years later, I served as a trustee of that college, and I would go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not so often in the state of Vermont where they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I came back to the neighborhood, and the question was what to do. And my uncles, who were Irish and ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman, because that's what my father had been, that's what my brother had been. That's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that work for the telephone company. But I told them I'd be unemployed for the next several years, and I had received a scholarship to law school, and I'd see them around. So I went off to law school. Didn't know anything about law school or lawyers. There were no lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. And I hate to be disloyal to the legal profession that has done so well for me, but I have to tell you that when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. Oh, they were deadly. Oh. And they all had on a blue suit and they wore eyeglasses. So I got a suit. In fact, this is it. And I got a pair of glasses I didn't need. And I looked for a companion, someone to drink with. Nobody drank in that crowd. They're all students. They're all grinding it out. So I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. Nobody's going to outgrind me. And as a result, I graduated well. I was taken into a large, white, Protestant Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. No, really? Oh, oh. My superiors there determined that I should go learn to be a trial lawyer in New York, so I did. I went to the New York courthouse and began to learn my business, and I noticed that the smart guys were really across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I learned to drink a whole different way. I never knew. I learned to drink in a way that was very genteel, very civilized. I learned scotch in a tall glass with ice and water. You sip on that. Takes a little while, but we'll get it done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround a very, very dry martini. And to this evening and to this minute, my love, my admiration and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal, and they destroyed me. After about a year of this civilizing influence, it was my time and to get married. And I had located this lady, or she had located me. Who knows how these things work? Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife. I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. We got married and set up housekeeping, and Ms. O'Keefe then began to produce children in a very boring and monotonous fashion, and with the regularity that is known only to the Roman Catholic. And very shortly after the second of those events, I received a phone call from the dean of the law school I had attended, and he asked me to come by, and I went to see him. And he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe. And I responded to that appointment with great alacrity, but I was also very nervous about it because I really wasn't sure what there was in my background to justify that kind of an appointment. And I knew that I drank too much. I knew that. Everybody knew that. So I decided I would drink less, and I entered into a period of controlled drinking. I was then 27 years of age, and I decided I would control my drinking. I could not do it. I tried. I could not do it. And after about 3 years of trying to control it, really trying to control it, getting no place, it turned out that I was able to hold that job. And I was able to be a competent professor of law. In fact, I am a professor of law right now. And so I enjoyed the work, and I was doing well with it. So, of course, you know, an alcoholic, when things are going well, you got to make a decision to fuck the whole thing up. So I decided I better stop trying to control this drinking because it was making me nervous, and I would go out and drink the way I knew how. I only knew the one way how to drink. My father died when I was 2, but I had an older brother, Billy. And if you looked at Billy and I side by side, you wouldn't take us to be brothers. Billy was about 6'3", and he was very handsome and good-looking and athletic and an all-around good guy. He was all of the things I was not. And Billy was my big brother, was my father, he was my hero. And whatever Billy did, I tried to do. I drank like my brother Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops showed up, or something happened. I would see people leaving. I went, where the hell are they going? You know, there must be something happening here I'm not onto. The whiskey is here. And I see them. They're walking right out over there. Made no sense to me, whatever. In the course of all of this, you know how the years click on. We ended up with a nice house in a little village called Larchmont, New York, and we had a bunch of kids, a lot of kids, lots of kids. And you'd see them, they're all over the place, little kids. We had a kid every year. Yeah, it was nice, a lot of kids. And belonged to the local clubs and had 2 cars, you know, all of the accoutrements of the middle class were mine. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. As a matter of fact, I would have told you I was doing very well whether you asked me or not. It was one of my speeches that I gave. Truth of the matter, at this time, at age 34, I was in big trouble and drunk every single day, all day long. Drunk from the morning to the night. Leave in the morning, drunk, drinking. Come back about 7:30, bounce off a few walls. Drink some more. Stay home, not stay home, didn't make much difference. Evenings, I would travel around the highways drunk. You know, somebody came to my law office one time and said, "Do you have any experience with drunken driving?" I said, about 400,000 miles, if you think that's going to help your case. And I would finish up my evening or my day trying to watch television with one eye like that, you know, trying to get those sets to go. And I'd go through all of the regular programming and the news and into the late show, the late, late, and all of that. And my big moment would come when they would play the national anthem. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And the airplanes would be flying by. And I would cry. Oh, it was so sad. This is such a country. Oh, Jesus. Oh. And I think about the war. Yeah. The war. The only war I was engaged was the war with Mrs. O'Keefe, in which we are still engaged, and I haven't fired a shot. And then I would go upstairs and wet the bed. Because I kept wetting the bed. That never stopped. Some things never change. While all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. Well, I pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she is my wife. How much can she know? Secondly, she is not an attorney. She does not have the benefit of a legal education. So why listen to that? So I would reason with her. I would explain things. I would explain to her, for instance, the relativity of drinking, which is to say that some people drink more than other people. And I would explain to her that on a scale, a relative scale, I was not such a big drinker. As a matter of fact, I would say to her, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much. Oh, well, you know, then I'd have to leave because then I'd go see Mama and we'd really get it going. So all of this drove her nuts, and she betook herself to her physician, whom, as you might expect, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him about me. I am one of the few men in Alcoholics Anonymous who came here upon the advice of a gynecologist. It's true. And the message she brought me from this man was that I was an alcoholic. Oh, brother. I rose to defend myself, as is my training, and I started in. And first of all, I took a very, very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without ever having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice, all too common in our country today. Then I went into high gear and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. You got it. And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a hell of a rate, and then it happened. It happened. I don't know how this happened. It happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I will explain many, many other things to you in the third or fourth hour of this terrific talk I am giving you. But I cannot explain this because in the middle of all of my yelling, I stopped. And I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I'd ever admitted to anyone, that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I had been only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. And I was overcome with great feelings of outrage and self-pity, because in addition to everything else terrible that was going on, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was hanging around there. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on this very day I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. They didn't want any further trouble. And he went away and left me. He abandoned me. Went away. And I woke up about a week later, came up for air, and I was visited by the staff of the hospital. This was long before anything like a 28-day program. This place probably better. They didn't know the first thing about it. They didn't have time to screw you up. But that's another subject. Forget that. Strike that. And the one in to see me was the head of the hospital, and I would have expected him. He said, "Tell me why you drink so much." So I told him. I had wealthy parents. They traveled a lot. Left me in the care of cruel servants who were black. And I became sort of a victim, and I had to drink. He was very sympathetic. He said I'd come to the right place. "Hang on," he said. I said, I will. Thank you so much. And he left. Another guy came in a little while later, same guy, different face. And he asked me the same question. So I told him. I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him about the time I got all those beatings from my drunken mother. Told him about the time my sister Marie took my rubber duck when I was 4 years of age. Never gave it back. He said that with his help and with the help of medical science, one day I could drink safely again. And I said, "Thank you, doctor." He's my kind of a doctor, this doctor. And the last guy in was so pathetic, I won't even tell you about him. And I thought I was very slick and clever. And, of course, they had a meeting the next morning, and they discussed, you know, the guy in 103. I was brought into a room almost this big. And the first guy told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. He said I was not cooperating. I was cooperating. I was playing bingo with three guys and Monopoly. We were playing Monopoly. There were three, four of us. They weren't alcoholics. They were just there, these guys. One of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do pretty good. I had the boardwalk, I had hotels, I was very happy. I was very happy with the Monopoly therapy. I don't know why I didn't go into that business. It's just as good as this horse shit they hand out over in these Twitch joints around here. But that's another subject. I'll get to that. So I'll play Monopoly, and all is well with me, and they say, "You have a visitor." Visit me, I don't know. So I go down and I wait, and through the door of this room comes this very, very imposing looking gentleman. And he said he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The hospital had asked him to speak to me because obviously the hospital couldn't get through to me. And I reverted to my origins, and I said, alcoholic, what the hell, are you crazy? And I went after him. And he, you're not going to believe this. You will not believe this. He told me to shut up. Really? I knew they had not informed him of who I was. So I began to talk. He told me to sit down, to shut up, and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking guy, and I was not a well person. So for the first time in 35 years, I sat. And he instructed me, as we are instructed in the book, where it says, tell them what you were like, not what it was like, what you were like, what happened, and what you are like now, which I have just done part of for you. And he told me that. And he said, would you like to go with me to meetings? I said, do you mean, sir, do you mean outside? He said, outside. I said, I'm going with you. So that's how it began. He took me around, and he made arrangements for me to go locally. I came back. I started going locally. I went to the Larchmont group. I don't remember so much of all of that. I was too new, too nervous, too afraid, too everything. And the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they used to insist on giving alcoholics. So I, in those days, this is 1963, in those days, alcoholism was considered to be caused by a serious Valium deficiency. So when they turned you loose, they always made sure you had a big jar of Valium. You'd never be deficient, you could eat it. And I did. They were blue and yellow, and I ate them, and my head buzzed a lot, so I don't know. But I know myself fairly well. I figured I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. I would serve a term as your president. We'd have a dinner like this, and that would be it. Well, I don't have to tell you the rest of it. 10 months later, I was very, very, very drunk. Very drunk. And drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power of this program. I turned my back on it for no reason, whatever. And so I drank, and I drank for a period of time. I'm not going to take you through it. It takes too long. It still makes me nervous. But let me just say to you this. It was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I would drink a week, then I wouldn't drink a month. I would drink a month, and then I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would come to these meetings, and then I would drink. I never knew when I'd be drinking or not drinking. Things began to happen to me that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me which I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you now of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty of the Fordham University School of Law as a tenured professor, dismissed. That all of the appointments, all of the honors, all of the commissions, all of the dollars were taken from me in about 15 minutes, with good reason. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those I knew. everything that all happened in this period of time. But it's not what I'm talking to you about. What I'm now able to see was happening to me at this time was that there was, in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible disintegration of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me even from each of you. This, whatever gives to this particular form, whatever personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing I could do about it. I had been here, and it did not work for me. And by this time, I've been everywhere else. I've been through the hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, the farms, the drying out places, the jobs, the friends, the politicians, the money. Everywhere I turned, it was the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I knew about it. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew about my family. I've been to the funerals. I knew why they died. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I drank. And if I gave this any thought at all, I guess I thought, well, if this is the way it is, then this is the way it is. And I tell you, as I am before you, that I really did not think that I would ever be able to stop drinking. I just didn't think so. But my time came one day. One day, my time came. Now, I don't know any more about this than you do. But it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And it seems to me that there is a point somewhere below which we are not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I do not know where this line is for you. How would I know? I only know what happened to me. And this, I think, is an individual and a personal thing. And I think it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They call one night from the veterans in Minneapolis. Said Billy had died of alcoholism. That he had collapsed on the skid row of Minneapolis, and they brought him to the vets, and he died. And so my brother and my hero died the way alcoholics sometimes do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood in the Bronx. But I tell you this, my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. That's how he stopped. And for other people, it can be something trivial. But that line is there somewhere. And we all come to it. We must come to it. It's known by a variety of terms. The bottom is one. We must come to it. Even though we do it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it, we must. And I arrived at a day not so different from thousands of other days. I was 2 or 3 days away from a drink. I was very thirsty. I was in this place where I worked. I was solvent. There was a bar in the lobby. And I was given a great grace to call a longtime friend of mine who's a longtime member of this program, and I told him what was going on with me, and he came over to see me. His name is John. He's my sponsor. And he walked in that room, and he looked so good. And I felt so bad. I said, what do I have to do, John, to be as successful as you are? He gave me that look. You know that look that sponsors have? He said, don't drink and you go to the meetings. You'll be all right. I said, you see, John, you really don't even understand the problem. The problem is I should never be working in a place like this. I'm too good a lawyer to be in this place. Yeah, he said, well, if you don't drink and you go to the meetings, you do a little better. I said, at home, it's worse, you know. I'm not even supposed to go up there. Yeah, he said, well, if you don't drink, you go to meetings. Probably get up there, all right. He said, I'm being sued by a bank. A little misunderstanding about a loan application. He said, I think I heard about that. Well, you don't drink, you go to meetings. Make some money, you pay off the bank. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did he, because he made a phone call or two, and he said, come on, and he took me over to Grand Central, and he put me on a train. It's about a 40-minute ride up to where I lived. And I arrived halfway up, you know, I'm thinking about things, and, you know, alcoholics start thinking about things. That's bad. I thought, what the hell did I call him for? I mean, I must have panicked, this moron. Don't drink, right? Don't drink my ass. Well, this train stops. And that was my attitude, and I got off the train, and standing on the platform of the Larchmont station was my mailman, the guy who delivered the mail, Al, who was then chairman of the local group. And Al said, get in the car. And I said, Al, please, I don't hang out with mailmen. I'm an attorney. Said, some guy called me about you. Get in the car. So I got in Al's car. I said, Al, I'm in big trouble. He said, yeah, I've heard about it. Well, he said, don't drink. You go to meetings. So here I am from out of town, and people want to ask my advice. You want some advice? I'll give you some advice. Don't drink. You go to meetings. You'll be all right. You'll be all right. By the third meeting, my sponsor bought me this book. You ever see this one? This one here. The blue one. It says Alcoholics Anonymous. This blue book. Not the red book. Not the blue, little blue book, not the green one, this one. And he said to me, read the black part. Read that part. Don't worry about this other part. I've never been able to be as good a sponsor as that man, and I've sponsored a lot of people. I've never been able to do it. I would say to him, Jesus, I don't feel good. He'd say, this is maybe as good as... I would say to him, as you know we do when we're new, when am I going to get a good job? He said, you had one. I said, I'm very, very, very nervous. What do you think I should do? He said, you should hang on. And I'd say, well, good. How should I hang on? He'd say, let go. And I would get all confused, and he would make believe he was illiterate, and he'd say, get the book, bring it over here, read me that part. And he'd tell me what to read, and I'd read it to him, and that would be the answer to my question. And I have come to have the experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is November the 24th, 1965. It's fair to say... I'm a certified old fart. I'm allowed now to tell you what it's like now, what I found in these 27 years. And I'm also supposed to tell you that when I speak, I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, I only speak for myself. I don't believe any of that. I am telling you the absolute truth here. This is it. And it's all in this book. And here's how it starts. I heard it start again this evening. And already you and I have said, you felt the power that's in this room. Have you not? You have. I have. I heard Bob say it. He stood right here and he said, God has all power. That's what he said. May you find him now. And then when he stopped reading, he said, A, he was alcoholic and could not manage his own life. I heard him say that. He said, B, probably no human power could relieve his alcoholism. He said, C, that God could and would if he was sought. And if God has all power and he could and would if he was sought, then the problem becomes very simple. And that is to seek God. You see, in the beginning, what my sponsor said to me is absolutely true. He said, don't drink and go to meetings. That's because of A, I was alcoholic and could not manage my own life. Don't drink and go to meetings, he said. But there is much, much more to Alcoholics Anonymous besides don't drink and go to meetings. Don't drink and go to meetings is to Alcoholics Anonymous as breathing is to living. If you don't inhale and exhale, you will not live, but there's a great deal more of life than inhale and out and exhale. And that's how it begins with you and with me and with all of us, by not drinking and going to the meetings. And something happens to us. The greatest understatement of the world, we say it all the time, what happened to him? Something happened. Something happened. Something happened. That's because of B. No human power can relieve our alcoholism. No human power. No Bill Wilson, no Bob Smith, no Ray O'Keefe, no doctor, no dentist, no podiatrist, psychiatrist, chiropodist, or groups of them. No human power. And this is not to speak badly of these people. It is not them. They do not have the capacity or the power to ail what's wrong with me. There is nothing in any doctor's black bag that's going to help me. As a matter of fact, everything he's got in that bag is going to hurt me. Because the problem centers in my mind, says the book. And no human power. And so what I had to do, and what you have to do, if I may tell you this, I had to make a decision in my life. A decision that's encompassed in our third step. I had to make that decision. I had to decide that I would seek God. That had to be done. And the book says when we make that decision, when we take that position, all kinds of remarkable things happen. It says we have a new employer. And we are the employee, a new principal, and we are the agents. And I tell you this, and you know it, any employer is going to give to an employee who's working for the employer everything he needs to complete that job. And when I made this decision many, many years ago, I have since been given every single thing I need to implement that decision and to do God's work. Don't ask me how. I don't know how it happens. People who are here tonight know me very well. Phones ring, things change, everything. Everything happens. Remarkable things, the book says. And let me tell you my experience, and if you are here more than just a little while, it's your experience as well, but just let me tell you my experience. And as the book says, God does not make hard terms with those who seek Him. That's what the book says. God does not make hard terms with those who seek Him. Is this a hard term? To come here on a Saturday? To be with people you know, people you understand, people who have your welfare at heart, people you even love? Is that a hard term? Not a hard term. It's not a hard term. And I speak to you of someone who I have no religious base. I'm not talking to you as a religious person. I'm not a churchgoer. It says this, it says, as we drew near to Him, He revealed Himself to us. Isn't that your experience? It's my experience. It's my experience in life. If you meet me for the first time, you're not going to know all about me. You want to know about me? You come down and get in my group. And get in my car, go for the meetings, and go for the coffee, and go for the ice cream. Draw near to me. And you, this is the way you are, is it not? Sure it is, the way we do it. And He is no different. As we draw near to Him, He reveals Himself to us. He is the God of the traditions, the loving God. This power, not human power, this power. Remember, He looked into your life, and He looked into my life. And when He looked at us, we were at our very worst. We were at that bottom at our very worst, with every defect of character and every shortcoming known to man in full blast. And yet this power looked at us and said, as we say in our seven-step prayer, I will find use for Him. I will move Him from here to there so that He will be useful and of maximum service to me and the people around me. Of maximum service. And I am here to tell you what the big book has told me. The spiritual life is not a theory. We must live it. And our rewards come to us in spiritual ways. I have received a great, great many material things since ever I became sober. I was born with nothing. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with nothing. Some days I think I have an arm. And the things that are given to us are not things that you can hold in your hand. They are the promises, for instance. You will know a new peace and a new happiness. You will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. You will comprehend the word serenity, and you will know peace. Are those hard terms? Do you remember? Don't you remember? Seeking that peace, trying to get somebody to understand what was wrong with us and wrong with them, and there was no help until here. You will comprehend the word serenity, and you will know peace. And God will do for you every single thing you could not do for yourself. And that includes your most secret wish, the one that you don't even utter or say. It will come. And the book says all of these things will come. They will always materialize if we work for them. And the book tells us where this power is. And the book tells us in very simple terms. It says deep down in every man and woman and child is the fundamental idea of God. Oh, it says we may cover it over with calamity, with pomp, with circumstances, but deep down it's there. And search for it, it says. Search for it. And it is in you. You are the power. Do you understand that? The power is you. You and the power are the same, and it's in that book. And it says, we found the power deep down within our own selves. This is how it was with us. And that's true. That's true. There is power in this room at this minute. And let me tell you, gang, it didn't come up here from Miami with me. You are the power. And I tell you just one more thing. And listen to this. I read this every morning. It's the last page of our book. It says, still you may say, I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write that book. We cannot be sure. God will disclose that to you. So you must remember that your real reliance must always be on Him. I have relied on all kinds of people and sometimes been disappointed. And sad to say, very sad to say, people have relied on me and have been disappointed. But this says reliance always is upon Him. Always. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Do you remember when you were new? When you craved that fellowship? Craved it, needed it, somebody to understand you, to speak with you, to be with you, to comfort you. Remember that? The early days. This says He will show you how to get that fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who still suffers. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you don't have. Obviously. See to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and for countless others. I hear that term a lot around Alcoholics Anonymous, relationships. I'm too old for relationships. But see to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and others. And I count this meeting as a great event that has come to pass for me and perhaps for you. And here's the final paragraph in our book. It's taken from the Oxford group. It's pure magic. These are my directions on the future. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find here. And surely you will meet some of us as we trudge the road of happy destiny. I would be remiss if I did not thank the committee, or who the hell it was, to have the uncommon good judgment to ask me to come up here. I know a great many people in this area of Florida, and I'm so happy to be with you. I am, as a lot of some of you know, I go around a lot. I say about the same thing. Everywhere I go, same old talk. And when I end, I talk about one of our pamphlets, which over the years has been very dear to me. It's called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I recommend it to you strongly. And at the very last page of that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical turn. And he recalls the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin, Jesus, as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him. And they stopped him. And they said to him one day, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we've been waiting for all this time, or should we just wait for another?" And the Lord really didn't answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John, and you tell John only what you have seen, and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see, and the lame walk. And tell John that the deaf can hear, and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear sisters and brothers, in happy intergroup banquet assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have heard and only what I have seen. And based on that personal observation. It seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. God bless you.